Chapter 31. For 2 or 3 days no more was said. She guessed from the sad countenances of her chamber companions that they regarded her not only as the favorite, but as the chosen, but they could see for themselves that she did not put herself in his way. Tess had never before known a time in which the thread of her life was so distinctly twisted of two strands, positive pleasure and positive pain. At the next cheese-making, the pair were again left alone together. The dairyman himself had been lending a hand, but Mr. Crick, as well as his wife, seemed latterly to have acquired a suspicion of mutual interest between these two, though they walked so circumspectly that suspicion was but of the faintest. Anyhow, the dairyman left them to themselves. They were breaking up the masses of curd before putting them into the vats. The operation resembled the act of crumbling bread on a large scale, and amid the immaculate whiteness of the curds, Tess Durbeyfield's hands showed themselves of the pinkness of the rose. Angel, who was filling the vats with his handful, suddenly ceased, and laid his hands flat upon hers. Her sleeves were rolled far above the elbow, and bending lower he kissed the inside vein of her soft arm. Although the early September weather was sultry, her arm, from her dabbling in the curds, was as cold and damp to his mouth as a new-gathered mushroom, and tasted of the whey. But she was such a sheaf of susceptibilities that her pulse was accelerated by the touch, her blood driven to her finer ends, and the cool arms flushed hot. Then, as though her heart had said, "Is coyness longer necessary? Truth is truth between man and woman, as between man and man," she lifted her eyes, and they beamed devotedly into his, as her lip rose in a tender half-smile. "Do you know why I did that, Tess?" he said. "Because you love me very much." "Yes, and as a preliminary to a new entreaty." "Not again." She looked a sudden fear that her resistance might break down under her own desire. "Oh, Tessie," he went on, "I cannot think why you are so tantalizing. Why do you disappoint me so? You seem almost like a coquette. Upon my life, you do, a coquette of the first urban water. They blow hot and blow cold, just as you do, and it is the very last sort of thing to expect to find in a retreat like Talbothay's." And yet, dearest, he quickly added, observing now the remark had cut her, "I know you to be the most honest, spotless creature that ever lived. So how can I suppose you a flirt? Tess, why don't you like the idea of being my wife, if you love me as you seem to do?" "I have never said I don't like the idea, and I never could say it, because it isn't true." The stress now getting beyond endurance, her lip quivered, and she was obliged to go away. Claire was so pained and perplexed that he ran after and caught her in the passage. Tell me, he said, passionately clasping her, in forgetfulness of his curdy hands, "do tell me that you won't belong to anybody but me." I will tell you," she exclaimed. "And I will give you a complete answer, if you will let me go now. I will tell you my experiences all about myself all." "Your experiences, dear?" "Yes, certainly. And number." He expressed assent in loving satire, looking into her face. "My Tess, no doubt, almost as many experiences as that wild convolvulus out there on the garden edge that opened itself this morning for the first time. Tell me anything, but don't use that wretched expression anymore about not being worthy of me." "I will try not. And I'll give you my reasons tomorrow next week." "Say on Sunday?" "Yes, on Sunday." At last she got away, and did not stop in her retreat till she was in the thicket of pollard willows at the lower side of the barton, where she could be quite unseen. Here Tess flung herself down upon the rustling undergrowth of spear grass, as upon a bed, and remained crouching in palpitating misery, broken by momentary shoots of joy, which her fears about the ending could not altogether suppress. In reality, she was drifting into acquiescence. Every seesaw of her breath, every wave of her blood, every pulse singing in her ears, was a voice that joined with nature in revolt against her scrupulousness. reckless, inconsiderate acceptance of him, too close with him at the altar, revealing nothing, and chancing discovery, to snatch ripe pleasure before the iron teeth of pain could have time to shut upon her. That was what love counseled, and in almost a terror of ecstasy Tess divined that, despite her many months of lonely self-chastisement, wrestlings, communings, schemes to lead a future of austere isolation, love's counsel would prevail. The afternoon advanced, and still she remained among the willows. She heard the rattle of taking down the pails from the fork stands, the ow-wow, which accompanied the getting together of the cows. But she did not go to the milking. They would see her agitation, and the dairyman, thinking the cause to be love alone, would good-naturedly tease her, and that harassment could not be borne. Her lover must have guessed her overwrought state, and invented some excuse for her non-appearance, for no inquiries were made or calls given. At 6:30 the sun settled down upon the levels, with the aspect of a great forge in the heavens, and presently a monstrous pumpkin-like moon arose on the other hand. The pollard willows, tortured out of their natural shape by incessant choppings, became spiny-haired monsters as they stood up against it. She went in, and upstairs without a light. It was now Wednesday. Thursday came, and Angel looked thoughtfully at her from a distance, but intruded in no way upon her. The indoor milkmaids, Marion and the rest, seemed to guess that something definite was afoot, for they did not force any remarks upon her in the bedchamber. Friday passed, Saturday. Tomorrow was the day. I shall give way, I shall say yes, I shall let myself marry him, I cannot help it, she jealously panted, with her hot face to the pillow that night, on hearing one of the other girls sigh his name in her sleep. I can't bear to let anybody have him but me. Yet it is a wrong to him, and may kill him when he knows. Oh my heart, oh oh oh. XXIX, now, who mid ye think I've heard news oh this morning? Said Dairyman Crick, as he sat down to breakfast next day, with a riddling gaze round upon the munching men and maids. And now, just who mid ye think? One guessed, and another guessed. Mrs. Crick did not guess, because she knew already. Well, said the dairyman, 'tis that slack twisted horse bird of a feller, Jack Dollop. He's lately got married to a widow woman. Not Jack Dollop? A villain to think o' that, said a milker. The name entered quickly into Tess Durbeyfield's consciousness, for it was the name of the lover who had wronged his sweetheart, and had afterwards been so roughly used by the young woman's mother in the butter churn. And had he married the valiant matron's daughter, as he promised? Asked Angel Clare absently, as he turned over the newspaper he was reading at the little table to which he was always banished by Mrs. Crick, in her sense of his gentility. Not he, sir. Never meant to, replied the dairyman. As I say, 'tis a widow woman, and as he had money, it seems £50 a year or so, and that was all he was after. They were married in a great hurry, and then she told him that, by marrying us he had lost her £50 a year. Just fancy the state o' my gentleman's mind at that news. Never such a cat-and-dog life as they've been leading ever since. Serve him will be right. But unluckily the poor woman gets the worst out. Well, the silly body should have told then sooner, that the ghost of her first man would trouble him, said Mrs. Crick. Eh, eh, responded the dairyman indecisively. Still, you can see exactly how it was. She wanted a home, and didn't like to run the risk of losing him. Don't ye think that was something like it, maidens? He glanced towards the row of girls. She ought to ha' told him, just before they went to church, when he could hardly have backed out, exclaimed Marion. Yes, she ought, agreed Iz. She must have seen what he was after, and should ha' refused him, cried Reddy spasmodically. And what do you say, my dear? Asked the dairyman of Tess. I think she ought to have told him the true state of things, or else refused him I don't know, replied Tess, the bread and butter choking her. Because if I'd have done either ought, said Beck Nibs, a married helper from one of the cottages. All's fair in love and war. I'd ah Mary then just as she did, and if he'd said two words to me about not telling him beforehand anything with some diver about my first chap that I hadn't chose to tell, I'd ah knocked him down why the rolling pin a scram little feller like he. Any woman could do it. The laughter which followed this sally was supplemented only by a sorry smile, for form's sake, from Tess. What was comedy to them was tragedy to her, and she could hardly bear their mirth. She soon rose from table, and, with an impression that Claire would soon follow her, went along a little wriggling path, now stepping to one side of the irrigating channels, and now to the other, till she stood by the main stream of the Var. Men had been cutting the water weeds higher up the river, and masses of them were floating past her moving islands of green crowfoot, whereon she might almost have ridden, long locks of which weed had lodged against the piles driven to keep the cows from crossing. Yes, there was the pain of it. This question of a woman telling her story the heaviest of crosses to herself seemed but amusement to others. It was as if people should laugh at martyrdom. Tessie came from behind her, and Claire sprang across the gully, alighting beside her feet. Why, wife, soon? No, no, I cannot. For your sake, oh, Mr. Claire, for your sake, I say no. Tess. Still I say no, she repeated. Not expecting this, he had put his arm lightly round her waist the moment after speaking, beneath her hanging tail of hair. The younger dairymaids, including Tess, break-faced with their hair loose on Sunday mornings, before building it up extra high for attending church, a style they could not adopt when milking with their heads against the cows. If S he had said S instead of O he would have kissed her, it had evidently been his intention. But her determined negative deterred his scrupulous heart. Their condition of domiciliary comradeship put her, as the woman, to such disadvantage by its enforced intercourse, that he felt it unfair to her to exercise any pressure of blandishment which he might have honestly employed had she been better able to avoid him. He released her momentarily imprisoned waist, and withheld the kiss. It all turned on that release. What had given her strength to refuse him this time was solely the tale of the widow told by the dairyman, and that would have been overcome in another moment. But Angel said no more. His face was perplexed. He went away. Day after day they met somewhat less constantly than before, and thus 2 or 3 weeks went by. The end of September drew near, and she could see in his eye that he might ask her again. His plan of procedure was different now, as though he had made up his mind that her negatives were, after all, only coyness and youth startled by the novelty of the proposal. The fitful evasiveness of her manner when the subject was under discussion countenanced the idea. So he played a more coaxing game, and while never going beyond words or attempting the renewal of caresses, he did his utmost orally. In this way Claire persistently wooed her in undertones like that of the purling milk at the cow's side, at Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.